Salve a tutti e benvenuti alla puntata numero 7 di Geek Cookies. Questa sera non chiuderemo la miniserie di due episodi su come realizzare un podcast, semplicemente perché abbiamo un ospite di eccezione. Siamo riusciti infatti ad agganciare all'ultimo momento un ospite estero e quindi abbiamo deciso di deviare dalla programmazione abituale. Essendo appunto un ospite estero, a breve lo introdurremo e inizieremo a parlare l'inglese. Quindi questa puntata sarà una puntata tutta parlata in inglese. Bando alle ciance, andiamo avanti e presentiamo tutti i personaggi di questa puntata. Allora, io sono Massimiliano, parlo da Livorno, e insieme a me, come al solito, c'è Mario da Berlino.
Buonasera a tutti.
Bene, l'ospite che abbiamo agganciato all'ultimo momento e che è qui con noi questa sera si chiama Michael Kennedy e è colui che conduce il podcast Talk a Python. Quindi introduciamo Michael. Hi Michael, how are you?
Hey, thank you very much for having me on the show. This is a great honor. Thanks.
Very great. So, Michael, would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure, I'd be glad to. So, I've been a developer for many years, and I've been a huge fan of podcasts for the last 10 or 15 years, and really enjoyed podcasts. And I've been doing a lot of Python, and I looked around, and I wanted to kind of interact with some Python podcasts. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. Maybe I wanted to sponsor one with a company that I work for. Maybe I wanted to try to be a guest or just start listening to them. And I realized there was no Python podcast at all. And Python is a huge, vibrant community. There's hundreds of thousands, maybe into the millions of developers. And I looked around and I saw there was no podcast at all. So I started my own. And I, about 2 months ago, created a podcast called, as you said, Talk Python to Me. And that's how we got to know each other.
Right.
That's great. Nice. So it's kind of, I think it's kind of interesting for me to see you creating a new podcast about Python, because I always thought that Python was one of those languages that are going to the, well, to the end of their life. At least that's what I thought. I introduced myself. I'm an experienced developer. I work on Java application since 10 years ago, at least. So that was my idea. That's great that you there's such an audience for that.
It's very interesting because Python has been around since 1990. It's older than Java. You know, it's almost as old as C++. And for a long time, it had many fans, but it wasn't super popular. I mean, it wasn't as popular as Java or C++ or, you know, .NET when that came around for building sort of main business type of applications. But something changed, and we can talk about what changed, and, you know, we can sort of speculate or think about some of those ideas. But something changed, I would say, probably around 2005, 2006. And Python has just been growing and growing in popularity since then. And it's a really vibrant community these days. It's, you know, becoming a more popular language and not less. You know, one example, I can't speak to Italy, but I know in the United States, all the universities here, they all have a computer science program. And traditionally, they've had sort of a first year class that all the computer science people take to get knowledgeable about, you know, things like data structures and algorithms and just basic programming concepts, right? Well, for a long time, that has been Java as the most popular programming language as your first language. There's been other ones as well, like Scheme and Lisp and so on, but Java has been the most popular one. And a year ago, 1 or 2 years ago, Python has become the most popular programming language for computer science in the American universities, places like MIT and Stanford, you know, those types of places are now doing, you know, lots of stuff with Python.
All right. So you mean that there's no MATLAB in university anymore, or at least this one has become more popular than MATLAB?
I would say it is becoming more popular for MATLAB for things like data science and absolutely for computer science. But not, I don't know for, you know, if you're a mathematician, you probably are still using MATLAB more or Mathematica or something like that. But Python is really becoming very, very popular in data sciences and big data, as well as sort of in the web space. Maybe we can tie or associate the growth of Python with the growth of cloud computing as well, right? The whole extreme growth of websites and web applications and services and backends and all that kind of stuff is really, really, you know, well suited to the types of things that Python does. Right. So I'm thinking back to 2005, 2006 when it became really popular, or more popular, let's say.
I think
that might be related.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say there might be some kind of tie in there that is related, right? I think, you know, if you come from a background like Java or C++ or .NET, you think of Python as kind of a scripting language. And it's kind of like this thing that you use, but it's not really what you would go and build your applications in, right? There's some really interesting use cases of Python. Like if you look at some of the things being built, there's some amazing applications or systems being built. For example, near you guys is CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, right? And those guys, you know, they recently discovered the Higgs boson and all that kind of really cool stuff. They have three experiments there. I think there are three, these huge, huge collectors where they collide the particles, and then they, you know, break them apart and they study them. One of them is called Atlas. And I don't know how much Atlas played a part in discovering the Higgs boson, but Atlas is largely done and controlled, and all that stuff is done through Python.
No way.
Isn't that amazing? Cool. Another example is YouTube. YouTube has millions of lines of Python and thousands of Python developers. If you look, I did this really cool show with this guy from PayPal called, his name is Mahmoud Hashemi, and you can check out his article. He did this thing called the 10 Myths of Enterprise Python, and talked about other places where it's being used in these really, really interesting ways. And one of them was like Bank of America has over 5,000 Python developers and like apps with millions of lines of code. And there's a whole bunch of examples like this that just go on and on. And I'm not really sure what it was that pushed Python sort of more into the mainstream. I think it's coming from several directions. You have these web applications. Data science is amazing in Python. It's becoming the most popular language for data science. And then, you know, it's always sort of had a bunch of other uses, you know, devices. And I know that we're maybe going to talk a little bit about some of the miniature devices you can use Python on.
I mean, I can speak from the side of the science because I studied science. I'm a physicist. More or less involved with data analysis. So data science is becoming my principal day-by-day stuff. So the two things that I see at most are Python and R are the two packages that are used at most for statistical analysis and big data and everything. But from my side, I mean, I started using Python because I find it, I mean, sexy. It's nice to use. It's easy to read. It's clear. And it's well documented. And the couple of packages that I'm using a lot scikit, the science scientific Python distribution, is scikit-learn.
And scikit-learn is very cool, yeah.
Documentation is amazing. I mean, it's really easy to read. It's fun. You learn a lot of stuff. You can use incredibly powerful techniques without even have to deal with low-level stuff. You can just, use a couple of objects and you can do amazing statistical analysis and produce science without having to write low-level stuff. I mean, for our side, it's really cool. But in our community, there's a lot of inertia still. There are still people using Fortran or even older stuff. They don't want to move because they have a mountain of code already written and they would never move to new stuff. I mean, yeah, it's a pity.
Yeah, that's really cool. And the whole NumPy and SciPy and data science thing is really, really amazing. It's, and then it, you, we were talking about MATLAB. What was the other
one? MATLAB.
Yeah, MATLAB. And you do all the graphics and so on. And there's a package in Python called matplotlib, yeah. And you just install it, and it will generate, you know, sort of production quality graphics for your scientific visualization. The other thing that you should check out if you're looking in that area is this thing called IPython.
Yep. Okay. I want to talk about it with you.
Yeah. Okay. IPython is really amazing. They're doing amazing stuff in the whole sciences around there. And it's very cool for sort of live data. The short version is, imagine you wrote a paper and you could put it online, but instead of the paper being static data that you saved and you just put on, you know, into a web page as an image, it could be live. And so you could actually, every time you look at it, it's working with the real data off of, you know, the ocean or the stock market or whatever, but it's graphics kind of like a printed article. That's the kind of stuff you can do with IPython. Cool. And it's cool.
There were, I guess it was Nature or Scientific or Science, they did an experiment, but it, you know, the notebook viewer, I mean, you can put your IPython notebook live. You can put as a static HTML page online and people can look at it. They make an experiment. It was something like, I guess it was based on Docker. And for every instance that you open, they add a Docker container running you on IPython. So you can open up IPython notebook online and run it. It was not static. So every user was served with a live running IPython engine beneath the cover. It was amazing. It was just
that
a test.
That is really, really cool. Yeah. That you can just, here's our article and go play with it, right? Try it out. But because of Docker, you're not going to hurt them, right? It's not going to, you know, so what if you hack it? You only hack yourself.
Yeah. That was really, really, really cool. And yeah. So another thing, I was really impressed. I mean, you think that today, which percentage of the whole World Wide Web or all the internet is driven by Python? There's a huge percentage, no?
Oh my gosh, that is...
I mean, not exact numbers, so a lot or less.
I would say a fair amount of the internet. You know, what you'll find on the really, really large sites, that you'll find some kind of combination, right? You won't find this is just a pure Python site or this is a Java site. You'll find different things at play there. So what happens a lot in the Python side is a lot of people write most of their application in Python, but there might be one part they write in Go or C++ or something like that, where it's, you know, okay, this is the part that has to be really, really fast.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to, or it needs to support insane concurrency. You know, there's one example I'm thinking of is there's a company, if people want to research it, there's a company called Discus, D-I-S-Q-U-S.
Yep.
It's great. It's nice.
Yeah.
You just put a little comment at the bottom of your site. And what's cool is it uses things like WebSockets and stuff to stay live. So if you're looking at a page and someone comments, you'll like see it change live. And those guys originally had written everything in Python, and they were supporting several hundred thousand concurrent requests on their Python website with millions of requests per, I don't know, what is the number, at least per hour. It's some insane number. They did a lot of public speaking and sort of documenting of their architecture. And in the end, I think they took a small portion of that and replaced it with Go. And they said it was much better. They could use fewer servers and things like that. But generally, you know, Python was fine. So what portion, I would say, I don't know, maybe guess 20%. I'm not entirely sure. That might be maybe high, maybe low. But that's kind of my sense that I get a feeling for it. There's too much PHP still in the world.
Okay.
And if can you compare to other languages and technologies like, Node.js, which I see to be quite, let's say, close to Python, at least they, overlap on some of the domains like server-side technologies, and I think it's quite popular and it's also having a lot of libraries pre-built that can be easily integrated on your own application. Can you compare to Node.js or similar technologies?
Yeah, of course. So I think Node.js is also really interesting. And Node.js is new and it's cool, right? It came out just 3 or 4 years ago, like 2010 or something like that. And what one of the hallmarks of Node.js is that it very much requires you to do everything possible in some asynchronous manner. So if you're going to talk to a file system, you begin talking to the file system and you set up a callback for when you have the data. If you're going to talk to a database, you set up a callback that's going to be called when the response from the database comes back. And it tries to make everything as asynchronous as possible. And so that's kind of the programming model there. And I think that's very different from Python, which is more procedural object oriented. Although one of the new features of Python 3 that just came out within the last 2 years, year and a half, something like that, is this asynchronous programming model, very much like Node.js supports. And that's in either 3.2 or 3.4, came out pretty recently, right? But the similarities are also very strong. They both have a very strong package management story. So Node.js has NPM, Node Package Manager, and Python has PyPI, Python Package Index. And I don't know how many packages are on the Node package repository, but in Python, there's like 56,000 libraries that you can go just say, pip install this. So if I want to do the graphs that I was talking about, I could say pip install matplotlib. Or if I wanted to do IPython, I'd say pip install IPython. Or if I wanted to create a website, I'd say pip install pyramid. Right? And these bring in all the frameworks and libraries that you need. And in that way, I think they're very similar, right? They both have this vibrant open source ecosystem with people adding packages and supporting these external libraries. And it's not Python by itself, really, or Node by itself that makes it so popular. It's really those things plus their super powerful package library that you can go grab.
Sorry, a bit of a noise.
Okay.
Well, it's really, really close. I was taking a look at NPM right now. They are listing to have 151,000 packages.
Yeah. 151,000 packages.
Okay, it's enough.
Well, it's really, really, really big. Anyway, it's interesting to see this language again. Live and kicking, it's really great. It's
something that I want to point. Sorry, can I?
Yeah, no, I was just asking Michael. You said that Python is a quite good language for all those people that want to learn developing an application. All right, let's take the point. Imagine one person that wants to start developing and has some clear application to develop in mind. Would you like to suggest Python for developing what? I don't know, if you want to develop server side, Python is good, or switch to this, or if you want to.
Yeah, so I think, if I could re-say the question is, when should I use Python maybe, and when should I not use Python?
Yeah.
Yeah, is that a good way to put it? So I would certainly consider using Python on a server, right? If I'm building a website, it's very easy to host and manage and deploy Python applications on the server. They have many, many super wonderful web frameworks, amazing database frameworks and things like that, REST APIs and so on. And so if I were trying to build that kind of thing, I would definitely recommend Python for that. If I was working with things like robots or devices, Python is actually very good for those types of things, surprisingly. So there's a project called ROS, R-O-S, the Robot Operating System. And one of the main ways to work with that is Python. And they actually have a robot on the International Space Station that's connected through a VPN back to Earth that's controlled, I believe, by Python. It's certainly controlled by ROS. I think it's RossPy. And that's pretty amazing. So that kind of stuff makes a lot of sense. The two areas that, you know, so let me stay on the good ones for a minute. The other good one is data science. If you look at this conference in the United States called Strata, S-T-R-A-T-A, Strata is the biggest data science conference in the United States. And for a long time, people were submitting talks in this language called R, which is like a big data framework. It's taught at a lot of universities and so on, as well as things like MATLAB. And in the past 2 or 3 years, the most popular technologies associated with these talks is Python and IPython and some of the libraries that Mario mentioned. So those all make great sense, right? Web, devices, big data. I would probably not use it for client-side stuff, right? If I was building like a GUI application, probably I wouldn't use it. You can. There's bindings into this thing called the Qt or Qt framework and other types of things like that. But there's probably better choices for client-side, like commercial-style apps. The other one is for mobile. There's something that works on Android called Kivy. And that's pretty cool. You can write your mobile apps in Python, but as far as I know, you can't do it on iOS. And if you can't write an app for iOS, you're probably not on mobile. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So until something shows up for iOS, I would say Python's not really a mobile choice.
Okay, nice. Thanks. What I want to mention before, I don't know if Node.js there is something like that, but it was... what I find really good in Python is the virtual environment stuff as well. I mean, if I wanted to install something without putting garbage on my system and just to test out some packages on stuff on with a lot of data dependencies, and so you can just create your virtual environment, put stuff there, run it, so activate and run it, and then deactivate it, nothing happens, and no harm done. That's really nice.
Yeah, that's really, really nice. I mean, think of something like Java or .NET where you install it on the machine, or, you know, if you get into Windows and COM and all these things that are super invasive to your system, you're like, I might not want to install this because I might not have a computer afterwards, right?
Yeah.
With Python, you can create these things called virtual environments, which are just local file system copies of the entire Python runtime. And then you can start installing any of these 56,000 packages or even others into it and version them and manage them separate from the main application, the main operating system. And it has, if you want it to go on, you delete that folder and there's just no trace of it. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Here's yeah, I agree, Mario.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah, it's very cool.
I think everyone, had a lesson from Microsoft that is messing up things, putting files everywhere.
Yeah, we've learned about the registry and yeah. COM and all the bad, bad things that can happen there. And
yeah.
We just know to stay away from that now.
Right.
All right, so. I don't know.
I go on or?
MicroPython? No, I was reading the...
Okay,
the topics. The one that we put on the...
Okay. I mean, I put some bullets on our list, and one of the things that I've seen in your podcast that I really like about it, that you always ask the people which one is your favorite package or packages, Python stuff. I mean, so do you have one of two things that you really like at most that you think they're awesome?
I have a ton of them that I love. Absolutely.
Okay, just a couple.
Yeah. So I don't want to get too deep, and I know this is sort of a general developer story, so I'll try to not like get too far into the details. So let me just like give you a sense of the Python ecosystem by covering some of these, right? So one of the things that seems to never get better is every time I create a new application, I have to, like a web application, I have to deal with users. And every time I have users, I have to make sure I deal with their passwords and their account resets and all that kind of stuff securely, because you don't want to be on the front page of Hacker News saying, oh, this site got hacked. A million passwords are now in the loose, you know, in the wild because of you. And so with Python, there's a package called passlib, and you can just say, here's the password, and these are how I want you to manage the encryption of it. So you can say, I would like you to use the SHA-512 hashing algorithm. I would like you to use this salt. And instead of hashing it one time before it goes in the database, hash it 40,000 times. So around and around and around and around. So it's computationally expensive to guess it. And then put that in there. And that's, you know, pip install passlib, passlib.encrypt. Boom, done. So passlib is very cool. I told you that creating standalone applications is not a great idea with Python, but if you're going to do it, there's something called Py2App, which will create a standalone Mac app.app file that you can run even if they don't have the right libraries or Python installed or anything like that, as well as CXFreeze. So that's cool. And then the big data stuff is, you know, SciPy, NumPy, Pandas, and IPython. Those are all amazing. So I could keep going, but I think that probably is a taste of it, yeah?
I want just to mention in the SciPy stack, do you use the Jupyter, the new IPython interface? That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, just for the does-knows is that, I mean, IPython is at the end is a web browser front-end for your IPython engine that you have behind, and the new evolution of this front end can use any kind of engine behind. I start to play with different stuff that I found online, and you can put like everything more or less inside. It's amazing.
Oh yeah, very cool.
That's really nice. Python 3, I guess, is that, or can they change the name just to mention that they not bind it to just Python anymore? But it's a really nice thing that I like from IPython, that when I start IPython, then I can bind my IPython console in terminal to that IPython kernel is running, sharing all the namespace on the variable. So I can have a couple of IPython notebook running, a couple of shell, then making graphs around and tweaking stuff. That's really
awesome. What kind of data do you work with? Are you I think you said you were an astrophysicist,
yeah,
is that correct?
Yeah, right. I'm planetary science more than other stuff. So we got geographical data, and I deal a lot with, there is a base map, I guess, and Kartify that are based on Matplotlib to make maps and stuff like that. A lot of database, because we got a lot of data that, a lot. I mean, it's not enterprise level, but we have a couple of millions. For us, it's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, okay. But with geographical data attached, so we have to put that on the map and start to make, something like with scikit-learn, trying to make sense of data that we get if we have structure in the data. So maybe we'll evolve with other things like, pstruct or other stuff, try to make model or stuff like that. So mostly data, data scraping, that's also another.
Yeah, it's really, really cool what you can do with Python with just a few lines of code, and boom, there it is alive.
Yeah.
It's very different than, say, C++ or something like that.
God. I never got into it. I'm really glad. But I know it's powerful, but not that versed in the stuff. Okay. So, thank you for cool. I absolutely have to test your passlib. It sounds really, really good.
Yeah, check out passlib. Okay. That thing just makes that easy, and it's so painful every time. And now it's done.
Okay, I have heard for your episode that which editor you use for Python? I heard PyCharm in your
shows. So I think this is kind of a big debate among this part of the world, and I suspect you'd find similar stuff among Node.js and Ruby as well. I spent a long time working on Silicon Graphics mainframes with just Emacs in the terminal.
Okay, I'm a Vimal, sorry.
Sorry, no offense.
Okay.
And so I did that for a long time, and you know, as software gets bigger and bigger, I feel like having something that really deeply understands every part of your application and your code is super helpful. And so I've been using something called PyCharm. There's other IDEs for Python, but I think PyCharm, you know, they have a free version, and it really is pretty amazing, all the help that it will give you, right? You can, even though you have a dynamic language, you can refactor, and it'll make sure it catches all the places that would have caused a problem. You might have forgotten a change, and, you know, things like that. So I'm willing to pay a few seconds waiting for startup to get a better editor. Okay. That's where I land. I know I'm maybe even in the minority, but that's me.
No, absolutely. I mean, I've seen some screenshots. I never tried, but the screenshot seems pretty good. And you can, I guess, you can inspect every variable that you defined, everything, debugging and stuff, and so.
Yeah, it'll give you cool intelligence, and they do crazy stuff. Like, you can run a debugging session where it will actually discover the types that get passed to a method. So in Python, unlike, say, Java or C++ or something, you don't declare the types that are passed in. So if you're in a method and you have a variable name, you're not really sure what that variable is ever going to be. It could be a string. It could be an integer. It could be a planet class. You never know, okay, right? And so PyCharm will actually look at the runtime behavior of your app and say, well, every time this method gets called, a planet object is passed here. There's nothing in the code that says it should be a planet, but it looks pretty much like it's always a planet. And so they'll give you IntelliSense for planet inside that method. Things like that are like, wow, that's really cool. So,
yeah, that's right. Let's do it soon. All right. I'm also a Node.js developer, and I'm using a simpler application that's called Brackets. I don't know if you had a chance to try it out.
I do know about Brackets. I haven't tried it out, but it looks really cool.
It is, indeed. It's quite easy, simple to use, and it doesn't have so many features that, I don't know, PyCharm has probably, or other more complex editors have. But it has plugins, and it seems that they started to be more polished and more focused on the project. So it is quite good, and it's worth using for all those that have, I don't know, low power machine that probably won't run that easily, a bigger application and things like that.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I think those are nice as well, right? I think Brackets, I did look at it. I never ended up using it. I think the equivalent for the Node.js developers would be something called WebStorm from the JetBrains guys. And even if you're on Windows, Microsoft has a plugin called Node Tools for Visual Studio that's also free. You know, and you can get a right version of, you know, the community edition of Visual Studio that's free, but all those are much, much bigger than Brackets.
All right. So moving on the points. So you mentioned that Python is quite good for all the things made server side, and you also mentioned Smallboard, if I do remember well. So we used that for some personal project. I think that Francesco made a surveillance system, and Mario made a baby phone for his daughter. I don't know if they want to spend a couple of words on that. Maybe.
Yeah, was that with MicroPython or something else?
No, I mean, personally, I guess we used both Raspberry Pi for the project, so it's plain mm-hmm. Python. Python 2, I guess, actually.
Yeah,
I
mean, yeah,
I'm
sure.
A Python 2 guy also, sorry.
Okay, that's fine.
That's a good question. I forget it.
Yeah, so with Raspberry Pi, you can put Python on there, and that's cool. And one of the shows I just did, but it's not public yet, was with a guy named Adrian Rosebrock, who does a lot of stuff with computer vision and building like cameras and auto detection. So you could do something like, he was talking about all sorts of cool stuff you could do with the Raspberry Pi, like get a $30 US dollar camera board, and you could use that and something called OpenCV.
Yeah. No,
and you could detect when your baby is moving even without sound and things like that.
I'm planning to do that. I'm not yet ready, but I'm going to try. There were also...
Yeah, so...
Sorry.
I was just going to say, I think that is one of the cases where Python makes a lot of sense. You control the little board. It's Linux. It runs Python super well. And Python is a really easy language to use in that case, right? So I think that's a great choice.
Well, and how Python is working on microcontrollers and smaller boards like the, I don't know, the Arduino or you do Neo that is going to be shipped quite soon. Is it working? Is it being translated to something more soon to the machine code or
something lower level?
Yeah.
I don't believe they do anything special. I think they just run straight what you call CPython, which is the Python interpreter that has some C, much of it implemented in C. So you would probably want to be a little bit careful to make sure that you take as much advantage of the libraries that have C extensions in them. A lot of the Python libraries have the option to either use a compiled part for their sort of hotspots, or they might use straight Python. You know, one example would be SQL Alchemy, right? You install it and it'll try to install this C compiled bits where it does the deserialization and stuff. And if that doesn't work, it can still run, but it takes more energy. And so you probably want to be a little careful about CPU there and pick the right libraries.
Okay, so you mean a little bit more optimization on the code, try to use the most, I got it.
There's a lot of things you can do in Python to make it faster that are easy, like use the built-in data types instead of creating your own classes and things like that, which you might not think to do, but those parts are written in C and your stuff is running interpreted. You can also use other interpreters. So there's different sort of runtimes for Python. There's one called PyPy, which you could easily run there. And that's like, it's kind of like Java and .NET. It's a JIT compiled runtime,
okay,
which is supposed to be faster and hence more, energy safe or preserving. And then there's also something called Jython, which is Python running sort of compiled to Java.
Wait, maybe a stupid question. You can use the same standard Python code with different compiler. That's right? Or
yes,
you have to write the same code?
No, you can use, for these things that I'm talking about, you can use the same Python and it'll just execute it differently.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
You can go farther. Like, for example, in Jython, you can import Java classes and use those. Then you're kind of stuck with Jython. And there's something called IronPython for .NET. Same thing for .NET.
Okay.
Long as you stay away from those special types, then you could run it anywhere. You could try it in one or the other and see which works.
Okay. So at the end, I can take the code that I'm writing today for the normal Python compiler and try other, so Jython, Oxide, and other stuff to see if the performance are better.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
That sounds pretty
good. Not every library necessarily can port over because sometimes they depend on C stuff and so on, but generally the code you write, that would be true. So you just look at the libraries.
Okay. That's more or less the problem that I've been talking before about the Python 2 and 3. That's why people stay into the 2 or not into the 3, because it depends on the library environment that you are living in. So you are linked to the stuff that you're using. You cannot import everything to different version.
Exactly. That can be a real challenge.
Okay, staying on this line, on the microcontroller and board, I put a couple of bullets in the topics. That was a little bit intrigued by the MicroPython development. There were, I guess, 1 year or 2 years ago, there was a Kickstarter campaign that was pretty successful. Some guys trying to Kickstarter a MicroPython that's a Python 3 derived small core that could run really with low energy on small microcontroller. And actually, they did it. And they also do the small microcontroller. It's in the range of $30, stuff like that. It's pretty cheap. It's a lot more or less with like a Raspberry Pi or Arduino. And
it's very small, right? It's like the size of your thumb or something. Yeah,
there are two thumbs, stuff like that. And they get a lot of IO. Yeah. huge dump, a lot of IO pins, and you can the coolest part is that you can really write, you can use the stuff like a USB stick, you could stick in your computer, put some Python code, and you can really control physical world using Python. You can send stuff using sensor attached to it or switch LEDs and send switch if they are on or closed and everything. You can just build stuff, real stuff, in the real world just using the Python that you use it to write. That's pretty amazing. I find it really cool.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with that as well. I'm actually having Damien, the guy who created that, on as a guest in the next month or two, so there'll be a full show on that. I haven't done too much with it, but from what it looks like, it's like the whole thing is written in Python, and so your code just sort of, you know, there's basically zero overhead to run your code because the microcontroller runs it directly, right? Which is amazing.
That's amazing. I mean, I was also browsing some, I guess it was Hackerspace. I mean, there was some website about there were... it is actually a small board that they use for the Arduino, just to make Arduino Wi-Fi capable. Some guys hack the firmware and recompile MicroPython to run on the stuff. This stuff costs something like $3, and it runs on, I don't know, 100 microampere, and it could run MicroPython on it. It's amazing. I
mean, people that's really stuff. Cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's really cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff you could build with that.
Yeah, we need time. That's the only thing that we can apply.
That's when the kids go to sleep. You get that hour to be creative.
All the night long. I mean, you had nothing to do.
That's right. You got all your energy left. It's fine.
Yeah, my God. I already have my small lab in a really dirty corner of my house. Oh, the whole house is full of kid stuff. And so... Okay, so guys, I think if you don't have any other points or question or stuff, I guess we are more pretty close to the end.
Yeah, I think we are done. Okay. Thank you very much, Michael, for joining us tonight in this show. It has been really interesting. We gave a great overview of Python, and we didn't give much of a review about your work, I think. So would you like to spend a couple of more words about your podcast and yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, everybody out there who speaks Italian and not as much English, I want to say thank you for listening to me, and hopefully I didn't speak too quickly. So I know how hard that can be, and I appreciate that. Thank you guys for having me on the podcast. This has been a really fun conversation. And if people want to learn more, you know, there's a lot of things you can do to get started in Python. There's some really nice online classes you can take. And I've, like you guys said, I started a podcast called Talk Python to Me. It's at talkpythontome.com. So check that out and subscribe to that as well. Have a lot of interesting guests like Damien, the guy who's doing the microcontrollers, will be on there soon, and so on. So thanks, guys, for having me.
Thank you very much. It was really nice to talk with you.
Yeah, you as well.
Thank you.
Okay, guys, so we're going to make the final stuff in Italian, okay?
Oh, sì, okay. Direi proprio di sì.
Bene, allora voglio ricordare a tutti i nostri contatti che sono su Twitter @jackcookiecast, la nostra mail che è jackcookiespodcast@gmail.com. E il nostro sito che è jetcookiesgithub.io. Su Facebook ci trovate come jetcookiecast e su Google Plus come jetcookies. Ricordo sempre che se volete commentare potete farlo su uno di questi siti attraverso i canali social o anche sul nostro sito, abbiamo un sistema di commenti, o su iTunes se volete, se vi piace il nostro podcast, lasciare qualche recensione e qualche rating. Vi ricordiamo sempre che sul nostro sito, quando abbiamo degli oggetti interessanti che potete comprare per fare qualcosa, abbiamo sempre un link affiliate che punta ad Amazon. Questo link ci permette di avere una piccola percentuale per mandare avanti il nostro podcast in maniera sempre migliore, quindi per comprare apparecchiature, per pagare spese, eccetera. Quindi noi non chiediamo donazioni, ma vogliamo semplicemente, tramite il vostro aiuto, che a voi non costa niente, cercare di migliorarci. Come ultimo credit della puntata dovuto, ricordiamo che la musica di apertura e chiusura sono prese da Jamendo, dalla sigla del gruppo Pornophonic, la canzone Sad Robot, che riesce da sotto Creative Commons, quindi dobbiamo ricordarvelo. Come ultimissima cosa, ricordiamo sempre che il codice sconto per la U2 dovrebbe essere valido fino a fine anno, il codice Geek Cookies, come il nome della nostra trasmissione, col quale avete il 10% di spese di sconto e spese di spedizione gratuite. In ultimo ricordo che questo podcast è stato montato grazie all'ottimo pod cleaner del nostro amico Alex, che è stato ospite la scorsa puntata.
Ok, ottimo. Insomma, okay,
perfetto.
No, abbiamo detto tutto.
Bravissimo.
Ok.
Quindi, con il cappello di chiusura, quindi abbiamo appunto finito e chiuso la puntata. Vi ringraziamo tutti quanti per essere stati qui con noi in questa puntata in inglese. E spero vi sia piaciuta. Ad ogni modo, mandate commenti e ci sentiamo alla prossima puntata. Okay, un saluto a tutti da Massimiliano.
So, tanti saluti da Mario, and a big thank you to Michael again. So, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.